The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Today we're going to look at unusual abilities that we each possess. Things like ESP, telepathy, and other forms of psychic intuition that centuries ago were called magic. My guest today is a scientist formerly with the government secret program known as Stargate, who has written a book called Real Magic, which looks at how we are evolving as a race, what inner dimensions we are finding we each possess, what makes us so special, and what we can look for in the future as psychic beings. All this in the news with Bruce Fenton on Earth Ancients. For Saturday, April 21st, 2021, this is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. Oh boy, got lots of goodies this week. I've been reporting on a granite box that I called a small temple when I was in Egypt at a place called Elephantine Island. And this place has a very, very ancient history. Pharaohs went there. We don't know how old it is. It probably predates any kind of written history that we understand, simply because a lot of the artifacts are extremely old. And right now, the German Institute has been excavating the island for a number of years. And when I was there in 2019 with the tour, there was this granite box. And this is one of the most amazing examples of advanced machining. And I've been waiting to hear from an expert on what they thought, how it was cut, what the possible tools are that cut this thing, and any details I could get on a engineering level. And so I sent our friend Jim O'Conn a video, a bunch of photographs, and even some measurements of this box. And for those of you who don't know who Jim O'Conn is, he wrote the book, The Lost Secrets of Mayan Technology, Corn, Cotton, and Chocolate, How the Maya Changed the World. And he has been regularly called in for accident scenes when buildings collapse. He's based in Atlanta, Florida. He is a genius. He's a forensic engineer. And he likes to call himself an archaeo-engineer because he uncovers a lot of the building techniques that the Maya use. In fact, he's famous for uncovering a bridge that had collapsed that's thousands and thousands of years ago in Guatemala. And his papers are now studied by archaeological students. So anyhow, I sent this to Jim to analyze, and he got back to me And what he said basically is that he's never seen anything like this before. It is a real, real out of place artifact, if there ever was one. And I actually called him this morning and got him to give me his view of this box, why it's so unique, and what really makes it fascinating. And you'll hear in this interview, he believes that it was machined. He doesn't know how it was machined, what technology was used, but it was machined. And the other thing that makes this analysis so fascinating is that he believes that there was some form of iron in the tooling, in the actual tool that cut this box. Now, before I play this short interview and his perspective on this, on the work, I should tell you, we don't know why this granite box is pushed on its side. There's a twin box that's identical to it on the other side of a long causeway, which is a walkway that's raised. This other granite box or small temple is completely blown apart. Now, I'm going to post a series of photographs on the Facebook page, Earth Ancients. Go to Earth Ancients, go to Facebook, go to groups. Automatically will post to earthancients.com website, so you can see it there. You'll see the details of this fascinating, fascinating work of machining. It's so anomalous. It's like something that you would order out of your gardening book for your backyard. It's so amazing. And I have found no reference to it in any archaeological journals, any suggestions, and I'll tell you why we don't hear about it. There's no way they can explain it. It literally is such an oddity that they cannot put words to it, and so they leave it alone. If a Orthodox archaeologist were to try to explain this, they would be lost. They can't. Because remember, for the most part, archaeologists believe that the Egyptians used copper chisels and wooden mallets to carve the blocks of granite and limestone that we see throughout the Giza Plateau, throughout Egypt. The factual evidence is that they must have used something else. So here's a quick interview with Jim O'Conn, the forensic engineer, this morning. So I have been talking about this granite box on Elephantine Island in Egypt for the last several months, and I hinted that I wanted to have the archaeoengineer, who's actually also a forensic engineer, Jim O'Conn, come on the program and talk about his analysis of this small temple, which is laying on its side. And the reason I wanted Jim to look at it is he's an expert, not only on lost technology of early ancient cultures, but also he can analyze a great deal for us just by looking at photographs. And so if you don't know Jim O'Conn, he is the author of The Lost Secrets of Mayan Technology. We had him on the show to talk about that. He also wrote a very, very good book called Corn, Cotton, and Chocolate, How the Maya Changed the World. And he just released a new book called Sitting in Hemingway's Chair, which is a look at his, not only meeting Hemingway, but also following his life and the way he did things. So, hey, Jim, welcome to Earth Ancients. How are you?
Fine, Cliff, and how are you?
I'm doing great. All right, hey, let's get into it. I sent you photos. I sent you a video. I've had a guy who builds homes look at this when he was with me a couple of years ago. We looked at it up close and personal. He said he felt this box was machined because it was so perfect. Let's start off by getting your analysis of your thoughts on its being machined or hand-carved. What do you say about that?
Well, the object we're talking about, an Elephantine Island, is amazing because it's a one-off piece. It's like a really special piece of sculpture that I'm calling a sculpture because it's actually an architectural piece.
Yeah.
It was done and refined to a point where all the details are absolutely precise on it. I mean, all the surfaces, all the corners are 90 degrees. The rounds are absolutely rounded and the molding is unbelievably formed. And it was done with a machine. It had to be done with machines. It could not have been done by hand.
Now, one of the things that archaeologists and specifically Egyptologists would like us to believe is that at this time period, and Elephantine Island goes back 3.5, 4, sometimes the thought is 5,000 years or older. Their belief is that copper was the main instrument to carve granite. What do you say about that?
Well, okay, there's a scale called the Mohr scale, which is the hardness of materials. Granite has a hardness of 5 on the Mohr scale, and copper has a hardness of 3. 3 is much softer than 5, and just like rocks cover paper in the old game, you can't cut granite with copper. It needed a much harder material, something like iron.
Yeah. So your speculation, and I had Jim write a paper based on his analysis of this box, and I have an article that I will be posting. It's going to be featured in Ancient Origins magazine. You believe that it was iron that was the primary tool to create this box. Why is iron the metal that you believe was the main tool?
Well, iron was the hardest still. I mean, the base metal is iron, but we got steel and we got magnesium and all those other kinds of hybrids of steel that have been developed since. But in that era, there was iron oxide, which is FeO3, that's a chemical formula, okay? Iron and oxide, oxygen together, bonded together. And it had a hardness of 6, which was enough to cut the granite. You could grill it, or you could grind it, or you could saw it with a harder material. And we do know that the Egyptians possessed iron 3,000 years BC. This is before the Second Dynasty. And Egyptologists say that they didn't use iron tools until 500 BC. Well, that's a 2,500-year lapse in a wonderful, brilliant society, which would have been able to take these iron trinkets and toys they had and made tools out of them. But they did, and they used iron, but it's gone. It's gone with the wind.
Yeah, it's evaporated. I didn't get into questioning you about the rate of speed that this machinery would have needed to revolve to allow whatever cutting tool was involved to cut this thing, but it had to spin at a pretty high rate, wouldn't it?
If you did it by hand, by just grinding, it would be a very, very, very unbelievably slow process. But you could have sped that up directly, but with a sort of a winch system that was a animal could have walked in a circle, turning a lever, and that lever could have been compounded down. Now I'm doing my fingers, it goes down to smaller and smaller levers, and the speed would pick up if he was walking at 2 miles an hour. By the time you get down to a tenth of the size of the diameter, he was up to 20 miles an hour. And that's a plenty fast speed for a piece of granite to be cut by an iron tool.
Yeah.
Either drill or saw.
I mean, have you ever seen anything like this box, this granite box?
No, that box is unique. I've been looking at, and I have been part of exploratory expeditions at the site of, I was part of the team that investigated the Age of the Sphinx 20 years ago.
Oh, really? You were actually at the site of the Sphinx. You never told me that.
Yes.
Real quickly, you and I talk about this a lot, and it seems like the orthodoxy doesn't really take your point of view or any engineer's point of view into consideration when they date or analyze these artifacts. Why do you think that is?
Because they don't believe in pure science. they believe in history. And then what they're studying is the visible objects they've recovered from the sites, from the graves. But if there's something like iron, which oxidizes at the rate iron oxidizes, it goes at a very slow rate if you use moisture. But in the desert, like in Egypt, it accelerates to 50 times that much a year. Wow. And over 3,000 years, it will just turn to dust. One inch of iron will turn into dust in the environment of the Egyptian desert in 100 years. Okay, so any tools that they had were not owned by the kings or the pharaohs, rather, but they were in use by artisans. They were handed down from father to son. And it was like an honorary or it was a dignified profession to be an artisan. And they would hand them down. And when they died, if they were buried, they were buried in a commoner's tomb or grave in the ground. And in that position, they would disintegrate. Yeah. So by the time 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, 1,500 years ago, all that iron would have turned into dust, and the archaeologists would not have been able to recover one single tool.
You speculate on that as well in terms of, in your book, The Secrets of Mayan Technology. If they had technology, we don't know what it was because it's all evaporated. Right. And what you're suggesting is if the Egyptians had some form of high technology, unless it's in a vacuum sealed box, we won't see it.
If it was not in King Tut's tomb, which was sealed up, dry, and no sunlight, it would be preserved. And there was a dagger, a steel dagger in his tomb. Okay. There was gold and there was bronze and there was copper, which do not have oxygen in its system. So they do not oxidize. But there was a steel dagger in King Tut's tomb. It was from meteorites. Meteorological, I guess you call it meteorological, right?
Yeah.
Iron. So,
yeah.
But that was preserved in a sealed tomb. But if the iron tool was buried with a commoner or an artisan, it disintegrated. It oxidized.
Hey, Jim O'Conn, thank you for giving us a few minutes. And we're going to see you back to talk about corn, cotton, and chocolate, your sweet spot on the How the Maya Changed the World. That's an excellent book. So, hey, Jim, thanks for spending a few minutes with us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Now, recently I communicated with Chris Dunn. This is in his expertise because he is the one who discovered these Ramsey sculptures that weigh 50 tons each and determined that they were machined using some kind of a template. And the carvings are so perfect that each one of them is a mirror of the other. And there's no way that it's carved by hand. It's carved with a piece of machinery. This box is something that Chris Dunn could probably give us greater details on. And I think what I'm going to do, now that I think of it, is reach out to him and send him some photographs. By the way, Chris Dunn will be with us next week to talk a little bit about this new northern shaft above the Queen's Chamber that Manu Seifzadeh presented to us in last week's program. He has followed up Manu's video with his own version and his own explanation. That video I will post next week, and he has some interesting things to say about the Great Pyramid, the Khufu Pyramid. So, but he's an engineer who really dissected these Ramsey II sculptures and offered it to, at the time he wrote the book, The Giza Power Plant. That book was Advanced Machining in Ancient Egypt. He sent a copy of that to Zahi Hawass, who at the time was the director of the Giza Plateau. And even Zahi had to sit back and go, wow, there's very, very good evidence here. Again, our historians are challenged in many ways because they have a real problem faced with scientific evidence on a lot of these buildings, artifacts, sculptures, and other remains that are not well understood by archaeologists. So, and I don't want to get into a whole anti-archaeologist rant here, but if you're not giving us the details and you're interpreting the past with limited vision or limited data, then you're not being fair to the public. You're not using the available scientific community to analyze your finds. And this is something that is a sad narrative from these academics. So anyhow, Chris Dunn will be with us next week. Okay, we've got a good show for you today. Dr. Dean Radin is going to talk about his book, Real Magic, and how humans are able to tap into different dimensions and produce some phenomenal effects. All right, away we go.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino. Asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Of all the boys I've known, and I've known some.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
All right, we're heading to England to check in with our science editor, and that is Bruce Fenton. And today we are talking about a new study that was done on the stones that make up the circles at Stonehenge. And there's some very peculiar aspects to these. Hey, Bruce, how you doing?
Hey, Cliff. Yeah, I'm doing pretty good. Thanks. Yourself?
I'm doing good. So what did they come up with on these stones? What was the analysis that they, it's pretty fascinating, actually. We were talking about it before we started, but what are the specifics?
Yeah, this is actually quite a good story because although people would assume probably that Stonehenge has been, you know, studied almost to death, you know, because of course it being such a famous monument, you know, so many teams of archaeologists have been there and, you know, researched it. And, you know, as we've covered in the past, it's had, you know, people looking at the acoustics, it's had, you know, what's buried there, what are the sites linked with it, you know, all of that's been done. But surprisingly, one of the things that hadn't really been examined in the past was the interior of the stones, you know, and really the makeup of the material, the age of the material. And the reason for that is because they are so kind of, you know, protected and conserved that you're not supposed to just go and, you know, drill a hole in them and start taking bits out. So that has always been an issue. But it turns out that there was a core sample that was taken out from one of the big Sarsen stones during the repair work, which was done back in the 1950s. I mean, some listeners maybe have seen the pictures of, there's black and white photos of the stones when they were being, some of them being stood back up. There was some repair work, quite considerable repair work was done. You know, some of the stones are cemented back together, in fact. So when that was being done, there was a core sample that was extracted from Stone 58, they call it. And that was basically taken to the US back in 1977 by a chap called Robert Phillips. Now, for years and years, obviously, he had this piece, which he had taken with permission when he left the UK. But they managed to get it returned for analysis in 2018. And with that, you know, in hand, they were able to kind of do a really close analysis of this material, which is called, it's called silcrete, the type of stone. Mm-hmm. It turns out that what it's actually made up of is very small pieces of quartz that are kind of packed together with, you know, larger quartz pieces. So it's almost entirely kind of quartz silica. And this is important for a few reasons, but particularly for its ability to weather. So, you know, with our wet climate, you know, it's obviously it would have really been eroded away if it had been, say, like, say, you know, normal sandstone blocks or something. But because it's this particular type of material, it's super resistant to weathering. And so it was kind of ideal for these kind of megalithic blocks that would be standing out in the elements, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it gives some sort of sense of these people, I guess, having a knowledge, you know, a good knowledge of the local stones. And this is taken from about 25 miles away from the site. So they're fairly local stones, these
But these stones weigh multiple tons. So they had to drag them or whatever they did to get them to the location they are now. It was extremely arduous to get those moved, I can imagine.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I know we say local. I mean, but if you think 25 miles,
that's a lot.
Moving these blocks that weigh, you know, multiple tons. And this is 4,500 years ago. So, I mean, when people think, you know, we think local. If you were to say to me, you know, hey, we're just going to take this block that's like, you know, 20 tons and move it 25 miles, that wouldn't feel very local anymore, would it? I mean, it would...
No.
So, I mean, we are talking about something extraordinary being done here. And it still isn't really understood, because when they did do a reconstruction of, you know, how this might be done, and they used logs, you know, rollers. But the rollers would snap or get stuck in the ground. You know, it was nowhere near as simple as people had, you know, had assumed. So when you consider that 4,500 years ago, that these guys somehow, not only did they move these blocks, but they also must have had a good knowledge of the stonework and understanding that this type of stone would have been particularly, you know, suitable for something that was going to weather. I mean,
yeah, I mean, weathering is just one part of it. We talked a little bit about having and selecting a stone that has so much quartz in it that maybe, you know, when sensitives are around these stones, they get all kinds of weird frequencies, voices, and, you know, these things on the acoustic side are off the scale in terms of their sensitivity and ability to project people's voices. But what we don't know, because we don't have a knowledge, is that maybe they're some kind of computer database bank, you know, or something that we just haven't been able to tap into.
Yeah, it definitely makes you think, because I mean, of course, we have things like the crystal skulls, which have rumors of being, you know, repositories of knowledge, you know, and stories of emerald tablets, again, of this crystalline material that's embedded with knowledge. And so now it turns out that these giant blocks are basically almost entirely quartz. And some of the English sites as well, the other ancient sites, ground quartz has been found on the ground scattered around. And they think the moonlight, you know, would reflect off it. And, you know, so it's clear quartz played a key role in these kind of sacred sites. So I don't think it's coincidental that they've used these blocks that are almost pure quartz. Yeah. And like you say, with the sound effects too, with, you know, they now understand that the site was designed for acoustics as well. So people had been playing instruments and stuff. Was that reverberating through the crystal somehow and doing something, you know, activating something? So, I mean, I know a lot of people would say, oh, it's very woo, but I mean, we know that there are some interesting properties to quartz. I mean, we use it today, you know, in our technologies a lot. We use silica and quartz. The first all crystal set radios involved, you know, quartz and pressure and stuff. So, I mean, it's not really just pure woo. I mean, it's just, I think that we don't necessarily understand what their knowledge was of, you know, quartz and silica. So again, this, I find it's very interesting. I think, yeah, it again harkens to maybe a lost knowledge, you know, a technology of some sort that we don't yet understand, but it seems to crop up at ancient sites.
We're going to post this on the Facebook page. Go to Facebook, go to Earth Ancients group page, beautiful big image of Stonehenge with a full moon. And then this short, easy to read, perhaps 5 minutes max to read the core sample, about the core sample, the sarsens, which are these huge inner circle stones that make up Stonehenge, and a little more details about the importance of this study, which Bruce has let us know, gets to the point, but obviously we haven't reached the level of technology, I believe, that was a part of the makeup of Stonehenge. So fantastic, a good one. Any last thoughts on this, Bruce?
I'm just, to echo that, I just think that at some point it's going to click and we're going to find some discovery that makes sense of this use of, you know, particular materials like quartz at sites around the world. I think there's just going to, there's some missing piece we haven't got yet.
Right. All right. Excellent. Take care. And we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you very much. Take care.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
So, Dean Radin, welcome to Destiny. In your work, it appears that as a parapsychologist, you are looking at the future of consciousness, perhaps where we may be going. And in the scientific study of consciousness, you're looking at things like clairvoyance, telepathy, and other states of mind that we normally don't really have an awareness of. Would you categorize parapsychology in that manner?
Well, in a sense, the psychic phenomena are not necessarily a forerunner of where we're going, but where we were. And it's in the sense that if you go back all the way to the origins of human history, and you look at shamanism, most of the practices involve one form of psychic phenomenon or another. Mm-hmm. You look through the whole esoteric history, all of the legends about esoteric magic and so on, all of it's about psychic phenomena. And so there, I think the evolution that we may be talking about is simply a recognition that such things actually do exist. So I would say that what parapsychology tells us is that the phenomena like psychic phenomena, which appear to be special powers, say, mm-hmm. that we might suspect or being evolved towards, is much more likely that we still have those abilities, but because of the demands of modern society and the many distractions that we face, we simply don't pay attention to what we already have.
Oh, interesting.
So one of the ways of seeing this, if you look back at classical yoga, for example, Patanjali wrote the book literally on classical yoga and devotes one of the four books of the Yoga Sutras to a description of and methods of development of what we would call psychic abilities, not only of the vanilla type, but of far beyond what we ordinarily think of as psychic, things like what you see in superhero movies. Hmm. So when you read about those powers, the cities, as they're called, it sounds like that's our far future. But in fact, it was our far past.
Now, when you say that we are coming back to this knowledge, are you saying that this is something that happened a few hundred years ago, or are you referring to the Hindu Vedas and the cities and the humanity at that time and how they functioned?
I'm saying that it is mostly from our ancient past, mm-hmm. but it's not because humans are different. Humans at least 10,000 or 50,000 years ago were virtually the same as we are today in many, many ways. Mm-hmm. The difference is that now we are saturated with distractions. Mm. The average person today is spending an ungodly amount of time on a smartphone and then sitting in front of a computer and listening or watching something, and it pulls our attention away from what we are capable of, but it's all there. Mm. Of course, this is not to say that some people are more talented than others. We all have different talents. But in general, based on what we know in parapsychology, if you can take a random stranger off the street and put them through a battery of different kinds of psychic tests and find that they generally can do something, like non-chance performance on one or more different kinds of psychic tasks.
Okay. You mentioned shamans, and a shaman is typically somebody who is working in these realms of higher consciousness, dimensional consciousness, if you can call it that. Would you say that the shamans that you've read about or actually have studied are where we were? Especially some of these shaman that are really, really have super abilities.
Well, I know contemporary shamans who have similar abilities. Some of them are naturally talented. They're just born with these abilities. Some spend enormous amounts of time doing meditation and rituals and lots of time away from the modern world in order to sustain it. So I suspect that if you take any average person, of course there is no such thing as the average person, but you take anybody who's interested in these sorts of things and put them into an environment like an ashram or some kind of retreat for a long enough time that they will begin to rediscover what they actually have, which is the whole panoply of psychic ability.
Hmm. That's interesting. Now, you've studied meditators versus non-meditators, and you've written about them. Do you see an advantage of someone who is a regular meditator versus a non-meditator? We have the term parapsychology, which is all these unique abilities to have precognition and so on and so forth. But would you say a meditator is going to have more ability or greater access to these abilities than a non-meditator?
Yeah, I think so. We have done surveys among beginning to advanced meditators and simply asked them what kinds of experiences that they have had that they can attribute to their practice. And about 75% of them report all of the classic psychic phenomena. One that's the most common is just synchronicities, meaningful coincidences that may in fact not be coincidences. But this becomes very common for people who spend any length of time beginning to or in advanced meditative states. So yeah, I mean it's not surprising either, because the whole point about meditation is attention training, and most of, if not all, psychic phenomena are bubbling up from the deep unconscious. So the more you can pay attention to your internal states, the more likely you're going to pick up psychic phenomena.
regarding meditation, I mean, there's different techniques, there's different schools of meditation or meditative thought and what to do. Did you find or have you found a specific technique within meditation that perhaps accesses these areas of the brain that lead to advanced states?
There's a little bit known from a neuroscience perspective, but every time we look at the brain in relationship to any kind of performance, it's always a correlation. So we don't know at this point whether the correlation is causal or what direction the causation goes. Mm-hmm. It may be that the mind is primary over the brain. I mean, there are two major different models going on here. One is that you are your brain, like your sense of self and consciousness and all the rest of it is literally being generated by the brain itself. Mm. In that sense, if you can manipulate the brain, you can manipulate consciousness and maybe capacities of what you are able to do. But from the other perspective, the brain is a very fancy kind of computer or perhaps a radio receiver. And so it's not producing the consciousness, it's simply manipulating it or receiving it. And that gives a very different picture then about what's going on. Since the program is about destiny and where we're likely headed, I think one of the things that we can predict at this point, because it's on the verge of happening, is editing the genetics of the brain itself. Because the tools for doing that now are relatively easy, they're effective, they're very powerful, and there are ways of changing the genetics of the brain. And when you change the genetics of a living system, more likely than not, the morphology will change as well. Mm-hmm. The connections, the shape, and so on.
So if I had to... are you suggesting there's techniques that an individual can use to change the brain's function?
Well, we know, for example, that if the almost as soon as you start doing a serious meditation practice, your brain is already changing. The shape itself will change in response to the meditative practice. And this is not all that surprising. I mean, if you start doing weightlifting, your body will change in response. So our bodies and brains are all highly reactive to whatever we do repeatedly. And that is also true for meditative practice. But what I'm saying here is that besides all of that, we now have the tools to be able to actually reshape the form and function of the brain itself. And that opens a brave new world. Hmm. Because now we're talking about accelerating evolution to an extent that was never possible before. And whether it leads to something good and exciting or something horrific, I don't think we know yet.
It makes me what your suggesting makes me think of Daniel A. Amen's work, where he actually will scan a brain to determine, in his case, problems in terms of personality disorders. In some cases, it's a pathology, a tumor, or whatever that's causing a state of mind. But have you detected through scans enhancements to the brain by meditators or any kind of advancements done by long-term meditators that can be detected?
Well, I haven't, but certainly that has been done. It's been shown that portions of the brain actually become thicker. Like I don't recall exactly which portion, but the some part of the cerebral cortex changes its shape and function as a result of doing long-term meditative practice. Hmm. Yeah, I mean, so I'm not a specialist in that area, but it's easy to find articles talking about that.
Well, let's check in with you on what you would see. Would you say a meditator has better cognition, memory, other attributes? How would you define a advanced meditator in terms of their cognition?
Everything you've just said, but most of the research to date has been on lowering stress, helping with hypertension, mm-hmm. that sort of thing, and helping with depression, helping Alzheimer's patients, many, many health-related, physical and mental health-related events. So as part of our, we had a long-term program with a bunch of colleagues looking at future research that probably ought to be done on advanced meditation, because to date, the vast majority of it has looked at the psychophysiological consequences. In other words, it makes you healthier and perhaps happier and less stressful. Mm-hmm. But the question is, given what we know historically about meditation, some of it was probably related to mental and physical health, but a lot of it really wasn't. A lot of it was related, especially in the yogic tradition, to as a tool to achieve enlightenment. Now, if you ask somebody what is enlightenment, well, you get 1,000 different answers. But in general, it's a way of seeing the reality as it is, rather than what you think it is. That's the essence, for example, of Vipassana, which is come out of the Buddhist tradition, and in its modern version, it's called mindfulness. Well, it's all about seeing the world as it is. I guess at some point you gain this state of realization or enlightenment where you can see the world as it is. People who achieve that state describe a very different way of being.
So I remember years ago the term was self-realization for meditators, which was the ultimate goal. I learned transcendental meditation when I was in my early 20s. Mm-hmm. And morphed it into something a little bit different now as I'm older. But as a meditator, would you say that is the best path to evolving a consciousness?
I would say yes, primarily because it doesn't require equipment. Mm-hmm. It doesn't require anything invasive. Like psychedelics, it's invasive in the sense that you take it and it does something to you from the outside. It's a slow process, so it's not like getting beaten over the head to cause a change. And it allows people to ease into a different way of being, perhaps without even realizing it. Mm. And so all of those, and also historically, it's the way to do it. I mean, historically, we didn't have very many alternatives, but we have such a long history of people using various forms of meditation. A very small percentage of people, something like 2% or so, are not suitable for meditation. They could end up having a psychotic break as a result. But that means something like 98% of people, which is most of us, can do perfectly well with it. In my own case, I'm not striving for enlightenment. I mean, that might be nice if that happened. I use it primarily for the mental and physical health aspects. For me in particular, it's for stress relief. And so just to give you an anecdote here, for many years, I've traveled around the world and do far too much traveling. At some point, because of the nature of travel now, where you're crushed in a can with a whole bunch of people for long periods of time, well, that's kind of stressful. And so I started taking little bits of Valium to simply calm down enough so that if I wanted to, I could go to sleep. Because otherwise, there's no way in the world I'm going to sleep on an airplane.
Right.
So during periods where my meditative practice is more disciplined, like every day for a certain length of time, I will forget to take Valium because my level of calmness is so deep that it doesn't even occur to me that I would need to take Valium. Hmm. By contrast, in times when maybe months will go by and I don't have the time or I forget or whatever, I'm not practicing, then I definitely need to take the Valium. So this is just a very simple way of demonstrating just to myself that the act of doing the meditative practice, 20 minutes or more per day, is kind of like taking a continuous Valium, except without the side effects a Valium. Like, I don't feel dopey. I feel actually clearer, but my stress level is just way lower. And so that's why I do the practice.
Are you still, during a stressful day, are you still needing to use, or I mean, excuse me, when you go flying, do you still use a little Valium occasionally?
I will if I'm on something like a 14-hour flight.
Oh, yeah.
That's overnight, and I need to go to sleep.
Yeah.
Because I can remain calm and basically meditate on the plane, but I'm not sleeping. So if I need to go into deep sleep, I will still take a Valium. It'll knock me out.
Yeah, I have a real big problem sleeping on long flights. I think it's the air and you're right, tin cans.
Yeah, it's everything. It's you can't move. It's just not pleasant.
It's tough. Yeah. In your work on consciousness, you write a lot about these exceptional states of mind. Can you provide us with a look at perhaps what we might look like in, say, 50 or 100 years from now? Do you think there will be radical changes in not only our perception of who we are in our world, but perhaps how we interact with others? And I'm not talking about perhaps both the average Joe and somebody who may be meditating for purposes of time, maybe just talk about somebody who meditates and what the world's going to look like in that time frame, 50 to 100 years.
Well, there's two ways of thinking about it. In one way, it won't be much different at all. We'll have new technological toys. And all of this, by the way, is assuming that climate change doesn't wipe us out. Right. Because if there's large disruption, we will very rapidly devolve into kind of a medieval time, where technology doesn't work very well and people become farmers and hunters again. That is a real possibility. But to be more optimistic about it, maybe the world will continue to revolve in the way it has before. We'll have new technological toys. Science and technology are so deeply linked now that it's very likely that we'll become more and more like cyborgs. We already have a lot of artificial things in our bodies that will only continue. And so one of the reasons why you read about Facebook and Elon Musk and others who are developing telepathic implants is because we now know enough about the correlations between brain and mind so that you could look at an MRI, for example, and not only tell from the activity of the brain that somebody is thinking or imagining something, but you're beginning to get to the point now where we can tell what they're thinking. So if you project that out 20 to 50 years, I think it becomes much more likely that we will have a technological form of some of the psychic phenomena, in particular telepathy. I think we will get to that stage sooner rather than later.
And why would you say telepathy, which is the, you know, communicating with somebody without speaking, why would that be the one that you see as a dominant enhancement?
Primarily because there's so much effort being put on it right now.
Okay.
Right. So it's an outgrowth. It's a kind of a natural evolutionary outgrowth of current neuroscience. And there's already, I mean, you can see papers and journals coming out a couple times a month where the brain-computer interface is no longer just an idea, but it's a growing discipline. So there are people who are specializing in that, and it's a marriage between computer science and neuroscience. It's being portrayed as what I was writing about 20 years ago, that one of the first areas where that would be used is in helping people who are quadriplegic regain body function through use of robotic exoskeletons, for example. Mm-hmm. So their actual body doesn't work that well, but if they can mentally control a robot suit that they get into, well, they can be like a normal person again because they'll have mental control of this robot suit. So that's coming along, and what's pushing it really hard is developments within the military to create super soldiers. That's right. Where a lot of the money and a lot of the initiative comes from, to make these super exoskeletons, unfortunately for military purposes, but there'll be spin-offs that will also help the civilian population.
Do you think there's a difference between an artificially enhanced ability to be telepathic and a naturally developed sense of telepathy?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so the brain-computer interface is sometimes called synthetic telepathy because it's not the real thing. The real telepathy is not so much about what somebody's thinking. It's not like getting thoughts in your head. The word actually means feeling at a distance. Hmm. And so sometimes you might get content, you might get cognitive content, but most of it is about feeling. It's as though probably the closest analogy is something like the Vulcan mind meld. Oh, you, right. It's not that you're getting information from somebody else, but that you are them. In the classical yogic sense, the city of telepathy, which of course has a Sanskrit name, but that city is not about receiving thoughts from somebody or exchanging thoughts. It's about being them. So that's quite different from what is developing into synthetic telepathy, because that's really just a slightly more complicated version of a smartphone.
Hmm.
The other thing is that synthetic telepathy at this point is getting better and better at receiving information about what you're thinking and perceiving, but it doesn't know how to transmit. We don't have ways, at least no easy ways at this point, of receiving something from one person's brain, translating it into thoughts, and then sticking it into somebody else's head. So that, again, is a big difference with real telepathy, because that's all about exchanging beingness rather than simply receiving without having any way to transmit it to another person.
Hmm.
And, of course, the other major thing is that telepathy is completely independent of electromagnetism. It's not carried by electromagnetic waves. It's independent of distance. And as best as we can tell, it's probably independent of time as well. So it's something that is operating outside of space-time. It's not like a radio wave.
Mm-hmm. These advanced meditators, I mean, you have done studies on telepathy. I know you have. And you've written mm-hmm. about them. I mean, in the distant past, was telepathy, do we know if telepathy was used as a way of communicating in a regular fashion, or was it just an occasional use for loved ones or people that you knew?
Well, in indigenous societies, even today, it is claimed that for emergency purposes, yes, telepathy could be used. I gave a talk a couple of years ago in Australia to some of the government ministers, and one of the aspects of the talk was about telepathy research. So I finished the talk, and then a person came up who was the minister of the Aborigine peoples, and she said that they had been using telepathy for 3,000 years. So she was pleased and somewhat amused that science is slowly beginning to catch up simply with demonstrating that it's a real thing. Because, as she said, that they didn't care whether somebody thought it was real or not. They were actually using it. Mm-hmm. So because we have other means of doing this now, like cell phones, it's not used as much, but it still can be used in an emergency if there's no other way to communicate.
Hmm. But do you see any research institutes actually beginning to write a manual on a protocol for using telepathy in any way?
Using real telepathy, not synthetic?
Yeah, real telepathy.
I haven't run across something like that. Probably the closest is something like the Silva Mind Control. Alcohol. They've changed their name now. Got rid of the mind control part. The Silva Method.
Silva Method. That's it.
Yeah. So part of what they teach is to remember how to do those kinds of abilities. A lot of it is still related to meditation. The Monroe Institute has the binaural beat technology, and some of their programs are designed to help enhance natural psychic ability. Mm-hmm. So, but I don't know anybody who's specializing in telepathy.
It's not one of those practices that you read a great deal about, and it's like, well, why do I need to do it? But I'm just thinking about something that people can begin. There's not enough written about it, is, I guess, my point. And if it's something that is a way to communicate with someone else, and there's benefits to it, and there is, it kind of trips and accesses a portion of our brain that's not being used, then we're looking at an evolution of some kind, don't you think?
Yeah, except I don't think it's brain-centric. I have mixed feelings about this, because from the neuroscience perspective, it's clear that the neural correlates of consciousness are quite real. Mm-hmm. But you're talking about
brain over mind, a physical brain over the mind, right? That's your issue.
Yeah, yeah, or the other way around. What is primary here? Is the brain? Are you your brain? Mm-hmm. Or are you something else and the brain happens to be a tool? Well, my guess at this point is that there's two ways of thinking about this. One is that you take a modern physics perspective and say, okay, everything that we consider to be physical at this point, including the brain, is best described by quantum mechanics. Now, quantum mechanics is not the end of physics. Eventually, something will supplant it. But at the present time, it's the best way that we – it's the best model that we have for what's going on in the physical world. So the thing about quantum mechanics is that it describes connections that transcend space and time. And even Einstein at one point just jokingly referred to things like quantum entanglement as a kind of telepathy between photons, because this connection was not physical as far as we know. It was some other form of connection that went through space, just like real telepathy seems to go through space. So the thing about quantum mechanics in the brain is that we already have evidence for quantum biology, meaning that some systems require quantum mechanics, or at least seem to require quantum mechanics in order to operate correctly. In addition, there are many aspects of the brain that are at the quantum scale. The neurons, the ions in the synapses between neurons, for example, are definitely at the quantum scale, which means they're going to have quantum properties, which means that some aspect of their behavior is not in space-time in a classical sense. And it immediately raises the possibility that most of your brain, most of the time, is inside your head. But there are aspects of it that are not inside your head. In fact, not even in space or time in the usual way. So you could begin to spin a plausibility case for why a more refined way of understanding matter itself, including the matter of the brain, can create a story where something like telepathy would simply be an outcome of the way that matter actually is. Mm-hmm. So it's not a naive form of reality. It's a more complex form. But the complex form would allow for these kinds of things. So that's one approach. And so I understand that. And sometimes I think that way. The other approach is more along the lines of the esoteric legends or lore, which says that actually consciousness is more fundamental than the physical world. And so what we see as quantum mechanics, what we see as information theory and a bunch of other things, is an outgrowth of pure awareness. So that is the Western and Eastern esoteric tradition. It's all about consciousness. From that perspective, since consciousness is primary over the physical world, it means that it is primary over concepts of the physical world. It is not in space, it is not in time, it does not involve matter, and it does not involve energy. It becomes before all of that, which means from that perspective, suddenly the whole range of psychic and mystical experience are easy to understand, because all of those experiences are strange only for one reason. They appear to not be in space and time, at least not in the classical sense. And that's because your consciousness isn't either. So This, of course, in the Eastern, at least in the Hindu tradition, is the phrase Atman equals Brahman. That you, the thing inside your head that you call me, is identical to a universal consciousness because it's all based in consciousness. That's the other. It's like every other Tuesday, I'm thinking of it in a quantum brain perspective, or the next week I'm thinking of it more in an idealistic perspective, where consciousness really is fundamental and the brain just happens to be a physical object that is correlated with it and allows us to have the experience of being human.
On a metaphysical level, there are a number of people, and Madame Blavatsky is one of them, and there's another, I think Rudolf Steiner is another person, who talks about these Akashic records. And when I think of the Akashic records, I think of a cloud, some vast cloud. We think of a computing cloud that certain individuals have access to. And I don't know if these individuals have a certain level of brain enhancement, mind enhancement, or whatever. But is that something that you are familiar with? And if so, if we have an ability to tap into this universal consciousness on a regular basis, does that fuel our evolution?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer. Mm-hmm. What I do know is that many of the people I know who are naturally psychic, and these are people who have psychic things happening to them all the time, and in a few cases I've had the opportunity to study them under laboratory conditions, and they perform quite well in the laboratory as well. Are they more advanced, like enlightened or healthier or something than the average person? The answer is no. In fact, oftentimes for people who are super psychic, The sensitivity is so high that, especially given the way that the modern world works, that they end up physically and actually not being that healthy. Hmm. They may overeat in order to kind of create a buffer around them to prevent the sensitivities from being felt so strongly. Sometimes mentally they're not that healthy, because you can imagine that if you advance your sensitivity to the point where you're extremely telepathic, well, you're going to be buffeted by everybody else's suffering all the time. Well, that's not pleasant. And so you can see from an evolutionary perspective that the way that a human has developed over many years is maybe 300,000 years ago, we were incredibly psychic, except that the ones who were really, really psychic wouldn't live very long. Because, as I said, they would become others, and others typically are suffering in one way or the other. So you're gonna absorb it all. Just would not be a very healthy organism. So we may well have evolved away from these natural states in order to live as an organism, in which case we are evolving away from psychic ability. And it's the people who are natural as psychics, in a sense, are kind of a throwback to the way we may have been before. And the ones who remain healthy and stable are a kind of mutation, perhaps. And this is not said in a bad way. We're all mutations of one type or another. But they're a particular mutation that allows them to be well-grounded and, in a sense, to tune in to the psychic side and use it when they wish. But they could also turn it off. Because if you can't turn it off, you're headed for a bad future.
But somebody who has access to this Akashic records, or I'm just going to use the word cloud because we talk about computing clouds, wouldn't that give them a special ability, say, to become an Einstein or become a Elon Musk, where you're inventing or manifesting tools and machines or whatever for the betterment of mankind?
Okay, so that's a very interesting question, because I get things sent to me in mail, sometimes by email, by people all the time who say that they got a download during a meditation. It is saturated with technical information, symbols, images, pictures, and they have no idea what to do with it.
Yeah. Because it's really advanced. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so advanced, that, and they don't have the technical language or understanding to know how to do, or like, what do I do with this information? They have an internal sense that it's really, really important. Like, this is the solution to our energy problems. This, you could build a UFO out of this thing, on and on and on. All kinds of stuff, which may in fact be true, except that they don't know how to interpret it. So all they can do is write pages and pages and pages of symbols and shapes and things. And so I don't know what to do with it either, because it wasn't my experience. So I'm just looking at how they represented it on paper, as opposed to, if I did have such an experience, well, maybe I have enough technical information about physics or whatever to say, oh, okay, I get it. Even still, even if a genius got that information, you can imagine if you showed someone like Benjamin Franklin an iPhone,
yeah,
and say, okay, here, Benjamin Franklin, here's something 300 years in your future, which is something that everybody on the planet has and allows you to watch TV and talk to each other and everything else. What would he do with that? And the answer is he wouldn't do anything with it in terms of understanding how it works, because not only is it microscopic, but the concepts that are required in order to understand how it works is so far beyond him that he wouldn't even have a way to begin to think about it. So you imagine if the Akashic Record is real, it spans all space and time. Our current understanding of that would be such a tiny little slice that if you're not lucky, you may be looking far beyond that to something which is astounding from our perspective, but you wouldn't know what to do with it. It'd be like taking somebody who doesn't know anything about electronics and then saying, okay, here's an iPhone. I'll give you a month. Do whatever you like, and then come back and tell me how it works.
Yeah. It's almost like you need a manual for every download that you get. And who's going to be the one who interprets the manual or teaches the manual? That's a fascinating concept. I think that's amazing. I have read about people who channel entities and things like that, and in some cases even suggesting ETs, extraterrestrials from other worlds, who have sent information through consciousness means, and they were able to translate it or write it down, but were not able to do anything with it because it was just so out of the realm of current ability.
Right.
So that's a great subject. I want to move into reality creation now, and you have done some fascinating studies with the use of intention, and this is something that I have been using in the last couple of years somewhat effectively. But can you talk a little bit about the importance of using intention?
Right. So the platitude is that we create our own reality. And this is absolutely true and demonstrably so in a psychological sense, that we know just from the everyday world that if you maintain a positive attitude, your experience of the world is going to be much, much more positive than if you maintain a negative attitude. If you read an article that simply primes you about something positive, you'll have a happier day. And if you read an article which makes you depressed, then the day will be more depressed. So this is happening constantly. And it's very powerful, because most of it's happening below the level of awareness. The question, though, then is, does your intention actually change? Is it not simply a psychological or a perception effect, but does it actually change something measurable in the world? Well, then it's a little bit more of an interesting question, from my perspective anyway. And so we do experiments looking at, does intention change? either how people respond to something or to physical systems change. And so the answer is yes, it does. To a very small extent, typically in the laboratory, we see really tiny effects, but the effects are quite real. And I always then follow that up with, and it's a good thing that they're really small, because there are many stories written about societies that develop ways of powerfully turning your intentions into reality, and all of those stories end badly. And it's really? Because, yes. One of the famous movies on this is Forbidden Planet. So on Forbidden Planet, people land on a planet, and there's some foreboding something happening in the background, and they eventually figure out that what's happening is that people's unconscious desires are manifesting. Uh-huh. And so what person gets angry at another person, we have impulse control consciously, but unconsciously we want to pound them. And so imagine we have a drug and we take the drug and everybody's now super psychic, including with their intention. The world would destroy itself in 20 minutes. Mm. I mean, every time somebody cut you off on the highway, even if you're enlightened, you're going to have a flash of anger. We can control it consciously. But unconsciously, if that anger manifested immediately, the other car would disappear or blow up or something.
Or you kill somebody.
Yeah. I mean, people are angry at each other for who knows what, all kinds of reasons. That anger, as I like to say, Jean-Paul Sartre, the philosopher, once wrote, hell is other people. Huh. And so this is more or less true, that a lot of times we get angry at other people because they're not doing something that we want to do. Well, if that anger manifested, we will destroy ourselves very quickly. Mm-hmm. And so this, again, may be one of the reasons why we have evolved away from extremely strong psychic abilities, is because it would destroy us. And maybe people in indigenous societies would usually have a shaman who was the combination of the healer and the leader and the warrior and all that. Sometimes they'd have to get rid of the shaman, because the shaman was both required and dangerous at the same time. Mm-hmm. So we may have slowly wiped out that ability. And today, for people who still have that as a natural ability, perhaps they're very successful in whatever work they're doing. They can manifest things so that it's producing continuous good luck for them, for example. Mm-hmm. But they may or may not realize that that's what's going on, but that may be one way of thinking about what's actually happening. They have a talent to manifest. Unfortunately, it's relatively weak, but it's real.
So is intention, in your thought, is it the beginning of full-blown reality creation, but it's guided, or I don't want to say guided, lack of a better word, it is somewhat controlled because you're not sure you're going to manifest, but hopefully the outcome when you set an intention for something to happen will be a positive outcome.
I would think of it more as intention to manifest something is tweaking probabilities. Think of now and then 10 minutes from now as a set of branching probabilistic states. Mm-hmm. And so if you're able to tweak the probabilities a little bit, you'll end up in a favorable state more likely than a state that you don't want. That's how I think about what's happening here. And the reason why this branching probability model works, or I think is a way of thinking about it, is because every time you have an intention for something to manifest, you're pushing against at least 7 billion other people who have intentions as well, and unknown numbers of other creatures out there who have their own versions of intentions. So if you have an intention for something major to happen, the likelihood is that you're going to start impinging on other people's intentions. Like if I want a gold Mercedes to show up on my driveway, well, it has to come from somewhere. And in coming from somewhere, it may be a zero-sum game and somebody else is losing something. Well, they're not going to like that. So there's an enormous amount of interaction going on with our intentions, and some of it is going to push back when you have an intention. Mm-hmm. I think this is one of the reasons why, at least in the magical traditions, the esoteric magical traditions, that spell casting was always done in secret. If you did a spell, you cannot tell anybody about it, because they may unconsciously pick up that something has happened, but you absolutely don't want to give them a clue consciously about what it is, because they're going to react to it. Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting when you look at the esoteric lore about the use of magic, because not all, but a lot of magic really was about using intention to get what you wanted. And unfortunately, a lot of time at the expense of somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In our time that we have left to us, Dean, I am curious about, I want to kind of go back to the Yoga Sutras. You talk about them and the extraordinary powers that these initiates had and possessed by practicing these techniques. As we look to the future, I'm reading about various drugs that are being worked on that enhance the brain, and there's other artificial means that are being suggested. You brought up one where we connect a computer to the brain and it accesses certain parts of the brain. Mm-hmm. And maybe helps in either manifestation or perhaps less so in maybe the telepathy. As you look to the future, do you think the natural methods are more beneficial, or is it a combination where we become like the Star Trek Borg, where we have implants that also support our ability to manifest, but also have a good life?
Well, we have been supplementing our natural abilities probably as long as humanity has been around, through things like caffeine and sugar. Mm. So that's going to continue. There's no reason to expect that the so-called nootropics or nutraceuticals for the brain and so on, all of that is going to continue to develop, as well as genetic methods are going to develop. In fact, I'm a consultant in a company that has several patents on a method of producing what was portrayed in the film Limitless.
Oh, yeah.
So in that film, it was never made clear how that substance would work, but because of methods now for doing very precise gene editing, the company has developed a method which has yet to be tested in humans, but in principle will eventually be a technology that will allow for development of what we would see today as super ability to concentrate, super ability to have visual acuity. It's like everything that we think of as cognitive has the potential of being souped up by a significant degree. And unlike the use of pharmaceuticals, it wouldn't have side effects. I mean, it would do what it is designed to do, but it wouldn't have side effects like becoming addictive or being bad for your body in some other way. It would be, in a sense, think of the brain as a kind of electrical circuit. Well, we're now souping it up with fancy new kinds of electronics so that it does what it's supposed to do, but in a much more efficient way. So I think that's going to happen, because this company I'm talking about is not the only one that's looking at this. There are a lot of companies now, mostly that are dealing with use of genetic engineering for either curing or stopping disease, mm-hmm. but also going way beyond that and enhancing us and to become homo superior rather than homo sapiens. That's happening.
Wow. And real quickly, homo superior is everything we talked about, these super parapsychological attributes and more.
Yes, and probably initially not so much on psychic phenomena, mm-hmm. although that would happen too. It's more like much improved memory, faster ways of thinking, perhaps doing things like lightning calculation. everything that we normally think of as ordinary cognition, but much, much faster and better. Mm. Yep.
Wow, fantastic.
So, and some of that would probably help in terms of ability to be psychic, like having very high ability to focus on something, maintaining very high attention. That would help most forms of psychic ability, especially for intention. If you can focus your attention to one point and keep it there, that helps in terms of intentional manifestation, because your mind is not wandering so much. Mm-hmm. Well, that would be one of the things that these kinds of genetic edits will allow.
Hmm. We like to leave our audience with one suggestion or more on enhancement, what we can use as a technique. Do you have a suggestion or a reference to something that can enhance our cognition that will begin setting in motion greater abilities for the future?
Well, so the answer is yes. And so it's a commercial for a device which I have no affiliation with. Is that okay?
Oh, that's fine. Yeah.
Okay.
Doesn't matter.
So for a number of years, I was using the Muse system, which is a fairly small and light EEG system that costs something like $200, mm-hmm. which is measuring your EEG, mostly in the frontal cortex. And it works with a smartphone and gives you basic instant feedback. So it's a neurofeedback device. It's taking something that would have cost $40,000 20 years ago, and now it's $200. So the Muse system now has a version 2, which is not only your EEG, but a lot of other physiological measures. Mm-hmm. And again, the working with a smartphone, it gives you real-time feedback about what's happening in your brain and in your body. And there's a fast way of bootstrapping yourself into a meditative state. For many people, it works really well. So if someone wanted to try that and had to spare $200 to buy the thing, I would say that would be a way of using modern technology, and it really is up-to-date technology, to do neurofeedback and biofeedback. Mm-hmm. And these techniques are quite effective for many people.
And give us a suggestion of what would happen with somebody who's using this technique. I mean, just in your own experience, what have you noticed?
Well, having done conventional meditation for many years, I would say that what this does is guide you into it guides you faster into the state that ordinary meditation is designed to do, mm-hmm. but it's a little bit faster because you're getting continual feedback about what is actually happening in your body. And since the mind and body are so closely related, if you can get help through biofeedback or neurofeedback to maintain extreme levels of calm, your mind will follow. And so I found that it does do that. That it, I forget exactly how long, it maybe did 15 minutes a day with the original Muse system. And I found after a couple of weeks that by following that method, that it got me pretty fast to what took years to learn in conventional meditation.
So when you say it got to you pretty fast, are you talking about that level where you were kind of in a non-sensory area? Which is, hemispheres of the brain were linked, or what? What does that mean?
No, so internally, I'm talking about the state of no mind.
Oh, state of no mind. Okay.
Yeah. It's like the chatter settles down to such a point that it feels empty in there.
Right.
So all that's left is awareness. So I can get into that state. It takes a while for, through ordinary meditation. And I'm just saying that the use of having the bio and neurofeedback helps guide you into that place a lot faster.
Interesting.
At least it did for me, and I think it does for other people have used it as well.
That's a very reasonable price, a couple hundred bucks. And it's Muse, M-U-S-E, Systems.
Yeah, well, it's I think the website actually is called choosemuse.com.
Oh, okay.
Well, Choose Muse. Yeah.
Okay, good. Hey, Dean Radin, thank you very much. I want those people to know about your website. I see it here as deanradin.com. It looks like that has all your latest. Is that a good reference for you?
Well, it's actually Dean Radin, but deanradin.com will lead you to deanradin.org, and deanradin.org is my personal website. So I work at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and that is noetic.org. And I'm also a professor at the California Institute of Integral Studies, which is CIIS.edu.
Okay. But, I mean, your personal website has all the latest. I see you have all these articles and all your research, and just your thought is
right.
Pretty much that's the one to go to. So fantastic.
Yeah.
Real pleasure, as always. And I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me on.
If you've ever wanted to see the ruins of an ancient culture, there's no better way to do it than join us at an Earth Ancients tour. And we have a big one coming up this fall, October 7th through the 17th. It's our annual Sacred Pyramid Tour of Central Mexico, and our home base will be Mexico City. This is your best opportunity to see ruins like Teotihuacan, the largest pyramids in the Americas, the Aztec ruins of Central Mexico, Mount Albán of Oaxaca, numerous museums and sacred sites, all for your enjoyment on a personal guided tour of these ancient places. This is a unique tour for Earth Ancients listeners, and we are giving you a 50% discount, unheard of in these times, for you to come and join us. All you got to do is get yourself down to Mexico City, and everything is covered. Your food, your beverages, your travel, and your accommodations are all part of the package. Again, this is our annual Sacred Pyramid Tour, October 7th through the 17th of this year. Come out and join us. For more information, go to earthancients.com/tours. Click on the banner and you'll have the full itinerary and get your registration in. Hope to see you. Dean's book's available on Amazon and at most bookstores. Major publisher St. Martin's Press is a heavy hitter, so distribution is all over the place. You can get the book pretty much anywhere. I hope you like that interview. Hey, if you're enjoying Earth Ancients and Destiny, please consider becoming a subscriber. For as little as $5 a month, you support the work we do here on these podcasts. And as much fun as it is to put on Destiny and Earth Ancients each week, it is a labor of love, and it does take resources to keep our team together. And the pandemic's been tough. We've lost people, not to death, obviously, but we have had people take off and move on and have to do their thing. So when you're a subscriber, you really help us keep the lights on. And to become a subscriber, go to Patreon. That's patreon.com/Earth Ancients and subscribe. $5, $10, $15, even $20 a month is a real big help. And we really appreciate it. We have some gifts for you. We have up to 15 ebooks. You can download many from well-known authors. We keep posting new ebooks every month, and this is our thank you for being a subscriber. Again, to subscribe, go to patreon.com/earthancients. All right, that's it for this week. I want to thank Dean Radden for being our guest. As always, Bruce Fenton and Ruth Thomas and all the other people who edit and are our production team. I want to thank you for your support. And we have a brand new show for you next week. And I hope you'll join us. Be well and take care.